Welcome back. It's a Tuesday, the 23rd day of August, 2022. I'm your host, Mark Gall. And you know what, folks? Your host is in kind of a whimsical mood today, given that it's the anniversary of a very important turning point in American history. We're still suffering the consequences, and I'll come back to that in just a minute. But therefore, I think it's an interesting day to lead off with, basically a whole bunch of headlines that might appear somewhat disjoint, but trust me, they all fit together, and maybe you can even guess where they lead. Economics, politics, war, maybe in that order, but again, they fit together. Let's start with this story via The Guardian and, of course, the Burning Platform, which says that in China, there's a drought, too. It's caused, not just the Danube and the Rhine in Europe, among others, and, of course, the Colorado and some other western rivers in the United States are having difficulties, too. But now the Yangtze in Asia to dry up and sparking, you got it, a shortage of hydropower. There's a nationwide alert issued. The southwest part of China has been especially hard hit, and major companies are forced to suspend work, or at least that's the official story. The pictures, though, certainly do look like the Yangtze River is in a world of hurt. And guess what nations do, folks, when they have these kind of problems? They blame somebody else, and usually shots end up getting fired, or worse. As we talked about yesterday, there was a car bomb execution outside of Moscow, and gigantic breaking news, says Hal Turner's report. The Russian government has now announced that there will be a, quote, military response over that car bombing, which killed Daria Dugina in Russia over the weekend. The suspected assassin is allegedly hiding out in a specific named country, Estonia, which also turns out to be a NATO member, and you can guess where that might lead to. And if you've been paying attention, you can probably also guess the deep state is salivating at the prospect.
I love it when a plan comes together.
From Europe, where natural gas prices just keep hitting new all-time highs, and that was even before Gazprom's latest announcement of more pipeline shutdowns, strongly suggesting, writes Natural News, that natural gas prices, probably as intended, will keep rising in coming days. They've now hit almost 242 euros per megawatt hour, which means, there aren't going to be that many people over there going to be able to afford electricity either. And maybe a lot of them are happy now that they didn't get suckered into electric cars. No doubt they're still, though, worrying how they're going to survive the coming winter. Well, remember, folks, and it looks like it's on track, because the plan is obviously world war. Which in turn brings me to a couple of brief but salient comments from Dr. Ron Paul, who writes for Lou Rockwell about how there's more and more and more billions being sent to Ukraine as America comes apart at the seams. There's a video clip he begins making the round showing the Biden viewer speaking at a recent NATO summit about, at that point, the $7 billion the U.S. government had provided already to Ukraine. Another clip, though, shows the horrific state of a number of, cesspool American cities, including in Pennsylvania, California, and Ohio. The video of the American cities is shocking. Endless landscapes of filth, trash, homelessness, open fires on the street, drug-addicted zombies, and certainly it doesn't look like the America most of us remember. But watching Biden, he says, bragging about sending billions of bucks abroad to corrupt leaders overseas, while American cities look like bombed-out Iraq or Libya, is, in fact, U.S. foreign policy in a nutshell. The Washington elites, he says, tell the rest of America that they must promote democracy in some far-off land while they never even have a concept of what the Constitution once provided here. Anyone who objects, writes Dr. Paul, is considered to be in league with the appointed enemy of the day. Once upon a time it was Saddam, then Assad, then Gaddafi, now it's Putin. The game is the same, it's just the names that have been changed. And, let's not forget, about 200,000 illegals reportedly crossed the border into the U.S. in the month of July alone. You can believe, he says, that they're learning quickly about all the free goodies provided by the U.S. government to illegals. They'll probably get to vote real soon as well. And he adds, you have to ask, do working Americans in Ohio or Pennsylvania think they're better off or safer for protecting Ukraine's borders? Most Americans, he says, are probably asking why they don't bother to protect our borders. Still, though, last Friday, he adds, the Pentagon announced that they're going to send yet another, $3.25 billion to Ukraine. And as Antiwar.com has reported, this was the 18th weapons package to Ukraine in just 6 months. Has there ever been a more idiotic U.S. intervention in our history? Supporters of this proxy war may celebrate more aid to Ukraine, but the reality is it's not really aid. That's not how the system works. It's money created out of thin air by the Fed, appropriated by Congress, to be spent propping up the politically connected military-industrial complex. And in fact, it's nothing but a big check written by Middle America to rich people who run Raytheon and Lockheed Martin, while the Beltway fat cats keep enjoying the gravy train. Bloomberg reported this summer that inflation is now costing the average American household more than $5,200 this year alone. And it's just getting rolling. No wonder Big Brother wants a standing army to keep cracking down on the peons that aren't going to be able to handle the blood being squeezed out of this turnip for too much longer. On then next to another Big Brother-related story or two, different front, same evil. The COVID-not vaccine, a.k.a. the Zyklon B injection, as your host prefers to term it, has now been linked, I hope you're sitting down, to new and recurrent cancers, because it turns out the poison poke does manage to cause severe damage to the immune system. Writes Ethan Huff for Natural News, people who got, vaccinated for the Wuhan booga booga flu while in remission for cancer are finding, that their cancers have returned. For example, Bonnie Eisenberg, 73-year-old, who's been 8 years in remission for breast cancer, is one of those who thought her disease was done in 2014. Well, up until she took the poison poke. Her tumors have since increased, including levels of CEA, or carcinoembryonic antigen, which is common to cancers not only the breast, but also the colon, rectum, prostate. She's been taking these tests every month for years. But not until after she got fully vaccinated to protect against Fauci's flu did her levels shoot up to the point where, she's in trouble. And she's not alone, folks. And America's Dr. Mengele, as it turns out, may be trying to get while the getting's good, but his evil lives on and isn't even remotely done yet, writes Tom Renz for his Substack. This will be short because it really doesn't need much comment. In fact, it's so absurd, I'm starting with the reference document because otherwise I didn't think anybody would believe it. It's called Spanish Flu, Gain of Function. And yeah, that's right, he says. Fauci et al. Are now actively performing gain of function work and infecting primates with, no, not just all the other things you've been hearing about, but Spanish flu to boot. The goal is to make it more functional, and you can guess what that means is among the many options still on the table for what's coming next. Because, as you may have noticed, a malady that affects primarily people who stick their you-know-what where it doesn't belong doesn't scare most Americans nearly as much as it's supposed to. So obviously, Big Brother needs lots of alternatives on deck. From Christina Layla at the Gateway Pundit and investigative reporter John Solomon, the Biden regime and the so-called White House did, in fact, in spite of the lies we've been told ever since, work directly with the Department of Justice and the National Archives to facilitate the bogus so-called investigation into Trump's handling of documents. This, according to memos reviewed by investigative reporter John Solomon. Remember, the regime has repeatedly claimed that Joe Biden had no knowledge of the raid. He found out about it in the media. And as your host has noted, that might be believable because even if he did know, he probably forgot it more than once. But still, according to the memos, the Biden regime's White House instigated the criminal investigation by eliminating Trump's claims to executive privilege, which opened the door for the next big move to put a wooden stake in the Constitution and everything that was once called the American Republic. And on that score, Jonathan Turley writes a piece called Litigation by Leak. Government officials, sick, have dropped new details on the Mar-a-Lago raid while continuing to oppose disclosures of what's really going on in court. One of the most glaring contradictions, he begins, in the Mar-a-Lago controversy has been the Justice Department demanding absolute and unwavering secrecy over the FBI raid, while officials continue to leak details about it. The latest example, a report in the New York Times that the Justice Department recovered, I hope you're sitting down, more than 300 documents with classified markings. And while most judges, writes Professor Turley would be a tad annoyed by the contradiction as the government continues to frame the public debate with its own selective leaks while using secrecy to bar other disclosures. All of this includes sections of the affidavit that detail the communications with the Trump team, information that's already known to the target. So what he says is, clearly, someone is lying. Team Trump said it was cooperating and would have given them access if the government had raised further objections, while the Justice Department has clearly indicated that time was of the essence to justify this literally unprecedented Banana Republic-style raid on the home of a former president. Yet, the man masquerading as Attorney General, Merrick Garland, reportedly waited for weeks to sign off on the application for a warrant, and then the FBI couldn't be bothered to cut their weekend short, so they waited to execute the warrant. So it's difficult, says Professor Turley, to understand just why such communications couldn't be released in a redacted affidavit while protecting more sensitive sections. They were really, as it turns out, only in a hurry when it suited them. Washington, he writes, is long floated on a sea of leaks, but it's notable in this case that Big Brother is opposing even modest disclosures from the court while they steadily leak details to their own advantage. And isn't it funny that the extraordinary level of detail didn't actually show up in the affidavit justifying the search? All of this, he concludes, is litigation by leak, where the government prevents others, including especially the target, from seeing key representations made to the court while releasing selective facts to their own advantage. And he says it shows utter contempt for the court and the public. The question is whether the court will ever take note of this series of leaks. Most judges don't like to be played so openly and publicly by government officials. And moreover, he says the leak should push Garland to reverse course and order substantive disclosures in the affidavit in light of the government's prior leaks. And no, your host suggests, don't count on it. Which takes me to the place that I've been working up to. This week is the 30th anniversary of one of the seminal events in the descent of the American Republic into an outright totalitarian tyranny, and certainly the rise of the American Gestapo as well. 30 years ago this past weekend, August 21st, 1992, the long-term setup by the FBI of a man named Randy Weaver came to fruition. The utterly unconstitutional ATF certainly has some dirty hands as well. As it turns out, Weaver had been set up and entrapped to saw off a couple of shotguns to just a fraction of an inch shorter than the unconstitutional National Firearms Act limit. They wanted to coerce him into becoming an informant against the, what else, domestic violent extremists of the day. And he refused. So they sent U.S. Marshals and federal agents and staked out his very rural property and cabin at Ruby Ridge, Idaho. On August 21st, 1992, Randy Weaver, a family friend Kevin Harris, and Randy's 14-year-old son Sammy Weaver and their dog Striker were walking in the property when the dogs alerted to the presence of something and started barking, which prompted the Marshals to shoot and kill Striker. "You son of a bitch, you shot my dog," said the teenager, who returned fire. And that was the last thing he ever said or did. A brief firefight ensued, and U.S. Marshal William Deegan was killed as well. The next day, the infamous Long Range Executioner, you've probably heard the name, and if you haven't, you should, Lon Horiuchi, FBI sniper, had been waiting several hundred yards away from the Weaver cabin. He was heard to brag about how he could shoot out the center of a quarter from that distance, while the Weaver family prepared young Sammy's body for burial. After shooting Randy Weaver in the back when he stepped out of the cabin, Horiuchi took aim at his wife, Vicky, as she held their infant daughter in the door of the cabin, and executed her with a single shot through the neck. And as James Bovard notes, the force of the .308 caliber bullet that crashed into Vicky Weaver's head had such force that skull and bone fragments went into Harris standing nearby, injuring him severely. And in the course of subsequent hearings and news reports, a whole lot more has come out about this disgusting, literally tyrannical overreach. For example, the grossly misnamed hostage rescue team of the FBI, then headed by Dick M. Rogers, who later served the same function at the executions in Waco, Texas, issued what turned out to be some, well, let's just put it as kindly as we can, questionable, albeit unconstitutional, orders. He changed the normal rules of engagement, which allow for the use of deadly force only when necessary to protect an innocent person from imminent peril, to something, well, let's just say, a little bit more Hitlerian. The new rules called on the FBI's execution team, snipers, to shoot any armed adult male who was outside the cabin. And it turns out, yeah, maybe a mom or two in the process would be great as well. When Randy Weaver was later tried in Idaho in 1993, and by the way, found innocent on just about every count, HRT Director Rogers was unable to cite any authority for allowing the FBI, in violation of Idaho state law, to shoot people who were posing no threat to anyone. And as David Koppel points out in his book, No More Wacos, when the new license to kill rule went into effect, neither Harris nor Randy Weaver, the only two surviving adult males at Ruby Ridge, knew of such a rule, nor indeed that the FBI was surrounding the cabin. Wrote investigative journalist James Bovard years later, the suspects were never given a warning, nor were they given a chance to surrender, and they had taken no action against the FBI agents. But as it turns out, folks, the American Gestapo was just getting started. During the next week, reports that book, the FBI used the microphones that they had installed to taunt the family. Good morning, Mrs. Weaver. We had pancakes for breakfast. What did you have? Asked the, agents at least once. Weaver's 16-year-old daughter, Sarah, who survived the encounter, said that baby Elisheba, who also survived the fall from her dead mother's arms, was often crying for her mother's milk when these FBI messages taunted them. The FBI later claimed, idiotically, that they didn't know Mrs. Weaver was dead, although there did turn out to be an FBI psychological profile that identified Vicki Weaver as the dominant member of the family and noted that if she were neutralized, maybe everyone else would surrender. As you may recall, the standoff eventually ended days later when Colonel Bo Greitz, for whom Randy Weaver had served in Vietnam, was successfully able to negotiate a peaceful surrender. In hindsight, that too turns out to have been a good thing for the Weavers because the FBI had plans on the very next day to launch the same kind of deadly final solution attack on the Weaver cabin that they later used with armored vehicles and CS chemical warfare agents on the Seventh-day Adventist sect called the Branch Davidians Church on April the 19th, 1993. Oh yeah, and Lon Horiuchi was there too, along with some of the same heroes from that earlier dress rehearsal. The standoff part of the story ended 8 days after Vicki Weaver was shot, when Bogreitz succeeded in convincing Weaver to surrender based on the promise that he would meet with famed criminal defense attorney Jerry Spence, who agreed to take the Weaver case pro bono. In April 1993, while the feds were working their magic down in Waco, Kevin Harris went on trial for murder, and Randy Weaver was charged with conspiracy to commit murder. I guess sometimes the government does believe in conspiracies, folks. Where Big Brother attempted to portray Weaver as a political and religious zealot who prophesied and then sought to create a holy war with federal agents, even though Weaver's clear goal had always been to avoid government agents. They claimed self-defense and that the government had unjustifiably fired first. And here's the irony, folks. With no defense evidence even introduced, the jury acquitted the accused of all charges of criminal violence. And then the court fined the federal government for withholding evidence and for lying, and complained that the FedGov had acted with, quote, a callous disregard for the rights of the defendants and the interests of justice, unquote. And, gee, look how far we've come since then. So many courts don't even bother with that anymore. Writes David Koppel, the jury appeared convinced that the wrong set of people were on trial. Which leads me to the other observations I wanted to make about this abomination 3 decades later. Because it's really interesting, I suggest, how so many of the same names just kept coming back and coming back. And now we know them for different reasons, but ultimately, even if it all still boils down to raw evil. For example, and this too shows just how far we've come, but in the wrong direction, a Justice Department internal investigation, yeah, they used to do that, compiled a 542-page report detailing the varieties of federal misconduct and cover-ups in the Ruby Ridge case and suggested, get this, criminal charges be filed against FBI officials involved in the abomination. Hey, guess what happened to that? In January of 1995, then FBI Director Louis Free announced, ooh, wrist slaps for the FBI officials involved, including his buddy and friend Larry Potts, who supervised the operation from FBI headquarters and approved the shoot without provocation orders that, as the report put it, contravened the Constitution of the United States. And when the evil Attorney General Janet Reno, you know, the butcher of Waco, later nominated Potts, you heard that right, for deputy director of the FBI, top newspapers and members of Congress protested. But a fellow named William Barr, and that name too is going to keep coming back, told the New York Times that his friend Potts was, quote, deliberate and careful, and I developed a great deal of confidence in his judgment. I can't think of enough good things to say about him, unquote. A few months later, wrote James Bovard in January of 2019, in connection with Barr's hearing to become, yep, Attorney General for the United States, Potts was suspended by the FBI after suspected perjury surrounding Ruby Ridge. He wasn't charged, of course, and retired with a cushy pension, you can rest assured, a couple of years later. And the Department of Justice then paid $3 million to surviving members of the Weber family, primarily his children, to settle the wrongful death lawsuit of their mother. But this is interesting. Hey, whatever happened to Lon Horiuchi, the sniper who shot and killed Vicki Weber and later showed up at Waco to commit still more murders, but this time on a grander scale? Eventually, the state of Idaho realized what was going on and decided to try that scumbag for murder, which is where the sainted, and I use that term with great big quotes around it, Bill Barr sprung into action. Notes Bovard, nobody asked during those hearings about Barr's legal crusade for blanket immunity for any federal agents who killed American citizens. Obviously, they've got it coming. And as we've seen recently, the intent certainly seems to be to expand that precedent to include all kinds of three-letter agencies, but especially the new 87,000 armed henchmen strong IRS Standing Army. Well, during the hearings, Barr received, says Bovard, a routine questionnaire from the Judiciary Committee asking him to disclose any past work, including pro bono activities, quote, serving the disadvantaged. And it turns out the disadvantaged that Barr spent the most time helping was an FBI agent, you know the name, don't you? Yeah, Lon Horiuchi, who executed Vicki Weber holding her baby Elishaba in 1992. Barr spent 2 weeks organizing former attorneys general, there's a whole bunch of scumbags there to pick from, I have no doubt, and others to support, quote, an FBI sniper in defending against criminal charges in connection with the Ruby Ridge incident. And he also said he assisted in framing legal arguments advanced in district court and in the subsequent appeal to the Ninth Circus. And as it turns out, writes Bovard, that charitable work for an FBI agent that already had a federally paid law firm defending him helped to tamp down one of the biggest scandals during Barr's time as Attorney General the first time around from 91 to early 93, where he was responsible for both the U.S. Marshals Service that killed Sammy's dog and kicked off the tyrannical demonstration that followed, and the Federal Bureau of Intimidation, two federal agencies whose misconduct at Ruby Ridge, quote, helped to weaken the bond of trust that must exist between ordinary Americans and our law enforcement agencies, according to a 1995 Senate Judiciary Committee report. And how's that for a laugher, folks? The bond of trust that exists between ordinary Americans and their federal masters. Oh, and if you're still curious, where is that murdering son of a you-know-what, Lon Horiuchi, today? Answer? You don't know, and you're not going to be told. What you do know, though, is that he's in the Federal Witness Protection Program, probably sipping down a pina colada somewhere. So yeah, how's that for accountability and that bond of trust? And I guess on this 30th anniversary week, we don't want to forget what Bill Barr was able to accomplish either. Not only the cover-up and protecting the guilty, many of whom, of course, went on to even greater crimes, Waco and elsewhere, but maybe you remember his greatest challenge, and of course success, when confronted with the election fraud evidence, and evidently asked to actually do his job, Bill Barr famously told the soon-to-be ex-president that those claims were bullshit. And that pretty well summarizes his career, at least in your host's opinion. But again, the bigger point here, really, is to see how far we've come from 30 years ago, when a man who basically just wanted to be alone with his family was set up, and then ultimately his family destroyed, and then the whole thing was covered up, and literally everybody involved at the federal level made their bones and went on to bigger and better tyranny in the years to come. And now we've seen everything from gain-of-function research to stolen elections to a new 87,000-strong standing army, and literally nothing to stand in the way of what they intend to do and have shown that they're fully capable of. Know the times and the seasons, folks, and make sure you know who you serve. May Yahuwah bless you and yours. Don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace.